From Washington, D.C., you are listening to Rule of Law Albania with Albi Cela.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of Rule of Law Albania. Today's guest is Fron Nazi. Fron is an expert on international development. He has developed programs related to good governance, rule of law, and democracy in the Balkans, Southeast Europe, Southeast Asia, and the Caucasus. During his career, he has worked for the McCain Institute, USAID, British Council, the Ford Foundation, Open Foundation, and also many other places. With Fron, we'll talk about his life, early life, his career, and the development work he has done in general, and especially in the Balkans. Today with me is also Pedro Pisano. He's a legal fellow at the McCain Institute here in Washington, D.C., and he comes back on Rule of Law Albania actually for the third time now. Guys, welcome.
Thanks.
So, Fron, before jumping in your work that you have done on international development, I wanted to talk a little about your early life. So you have moved to the United States from the Balkans in your early years of life. How was it? So you moved from Albania to Kosovo first, as far as I know, and then from Kosovo to the streets of Bronx in New York. So how was your childhood back then?
So I'm a professional immigrant. So we were kicked out of Albania, kicked out of Kosovo and Yugoslavia, came into the Bronx. We spent some years there, kicked out of the Bronx because it was too rough. And then I grew up in upstate New York. So the youth is, I just remember it always being in transition. You're always going, trying to find your homeland. And your homeland is quite often is obviously the neighborhood you live in. So my youth is, I recall very well, not obviously, you know, not really understanding English all that well. So you rely on your community. In my particular community, obviously being run by my father. So during the developing years, you'll live in the past if you're an immigrant, because you spend a lot of time listening to your parents and his family, their family and their friends talking about the old country. So the first years until you become sort of a teenager, you tend to live between these two worlds. One, obviously, United States being very progressive, and the other one is where your parents and their friends, because they don't speak the language, live in the past, quite often stuck exactly wondering what's happening. So that was my sort of upbringing, and it's something that stuck with me. I'll stop there for a second.
Okay, Pedro, you want to jump in with something? So sure, for everyone today, Pedro is my co-host, so we will be riding shotgun together today.
Yes.
Thank you. Hopefully, Fron will also post it on his podcast and he'll be the co-host. But I wanted to ask a little more about that living in two worlds, because Albi and I are both wannabe immigrants. And so what does coming to this country mean both back then and today?
Well, you know, okay, I'm not saying nothing new that hasn't been said before. So for every single person in that comes from a developing or, you know, transitional society, the United States is viewed as the Elysian Fields. And they're really, you know, and you have this image that's built, obviously, you know, thinking about just the word America spurs on this incredible image. The reality sets in when we moved into New York City. Because what happens is you're one of 300 million people looking to survive. And you're thrown into this situation. We were thrown in the Bronx when we first arrived. There's no handbook on how you're supposed to make it. The one handbook they give you is just don't break the law and you'll be fine. And the rest of it really is about your community. It's about your neighborhood. It's about other people. But that, as I said, if you'll tell even from everything I do, I've never been able to walk away from my immigrant experience. I still wonder, sooner or later, someone's gonna tap me on my shoulder and go, hey, Fron, wake up, it's time to go back, wherever that back is. And we can talk about living in these worlds. So United States are always viewed as an Albanian American. I think both of you guys have this experience, respectfully, from your own. back in your own country, you'd use it as an American. And so I defined it sometime as those of us who come from these countries, or the first generation, are what we call non-sortable, especially if we play the international, in the international arena. So when I was working overseas, people were confused. Was I an Albanian? Was I an American? Or was I neither, or both, or so forth? The reason for that is because obviously it's the way we approach things as well. So the Balkan mentality, Eastern European mentality, is one where we question and open much more debate, and also a very different kind of sense of humor, very dark humor, versus an American approach, which is always about providing solutions. You go in, you look at the problem, you find a solution, and then you say, you know. So those two, combining those two, was always fascinating. The best description I can come up with is sort of like, I think now at the middle age that I'm, where I am, is that the hardware is Albanian, the software is American.
Okay, so Fran, just curious. So you were raised in an Albanian family, and I know from my experience that Albanian families are really orthodox when it comes to their national identity. So what has your experience been with your family?
Like, well, look, you know, my father was spent 5 years in prison, you know, when he was in Albania with the communist regime. We had family members that were killed. I had sisters, which I never met, that lived in Albania. So there was this staunch anti-communism, and quite often there was a romantic idea of what Albania looked like. And also the myth about our culture, you know, Albanian culture is like being honorable and everything else. And also they tend to, like everybody else, really build up where you come from. Unfortunately, in my case, that came to a starch reality that although my parents and my father meant extremely well, when I returned to Albania in 1991, and I visit these places that my father spoke about, they weren't anything like I imagined them in my head. I found a different reality than the one he spoke about. But a better understanding of why anybody would do that, we could talk a little later about that. So from the fact that I had the opportunity to live and see Albania right after the fall of communism, I'm not sure to this day it's the same society that my father spoke about. But I didn't find what I thought, you know, this mythical society, which was honorable, which was respectful. In fact, as you know from my own writings, I found a society is extremely corrupt, extremely selfish. There was absolutely no national identity. And a society that really, really loved to live in its own mistakes. And by the mistakes, I mean is by the political leaders that you continue to choose.
I understand. Pedro? Want to add something?
So much, but it's just such an extraordinary viewpoint, not only into probably the most fascinating country in that region, or at least thanks to you both and other friends, Colombians and Albanians have a special relationship, but also in the way that you approach the problem of international development, right? You have these two hats or two identities or many identities. And so it both affects you personally, but you're also removed. So how does that experience, just to go a little bit deeper into that, help you understand the problem of development?
That's a really, really, a really good question, Pedro. And it's something, I mean, look, it's a pod and cast and we're talking, but I went into international development as an idealist. I sincerely thought that we would change the world and I'd be part of that. You're 26 years old, you're the head of a foundation, you're involved in revolution, about to tear down a totalitarian system, which we call communism. In the process, you get the most amazing education you ever could possibly think, because you're meeting the revolutionaries, if you want to call it in a positive sense, you're meeting the intellectuals, not only in Albania, but in Central Eastern Europe. So you have a front row seat to the past and the future. And whatever you learned at the university, you just took out and you realized that you should have spent more time in the library. As far as understanding the concept of what is a post-totalitarian system supposed to look like? And for me, I had the fortune of realizing that I was not an expert, and I still don't know why I was there. But unfortunately, because a lot of places like Albania, where I was working at that time, it was so poor that any kind of proposal I made was applauded and welcomed. And it's really easy to be corrupted by that because you take the, you know, because there's money behind it. So if I said, let's plant 1,000 flowers, the Albanians would rush to the foundation and said, hey, I'm ready to plant flowers. You know? And so one of the things that you try to do is because of your humble background, you know, as a refugee, as an immigrant all my life, you remember the hardships yourself and the good and the bad. And you realize you don't want to take person's dignity away by, and that was always a challenge, is how do you do this without taking a person's dignity? So in Albania in particular, it was very difficult because of the political situation there. I felt in Albania, because of what I learned from the dissidents in Poland and Hungary, you know, in Bulgaria and elsewhere, that the one thing that was missing Albania, and maybe Albi can speak about it as well, is this national identity. So there was a lot of interest in culture, and the Albanian intellectuals needed really to express themselves. And there were some brilliant writings at that time. There were just some amazing folks, and also they were looking almost to say that we can, for example, compare ourselves to the Europeans, and they want to know more about those. And then the other hand, you had obviously the businessmen who quickly learned how to use the system. The politicians turned around and made a decision that obviously you don't want culture because culture brings criticism and challenges, but you do want the business. So what they did quite often was saying, we can do without this, and the only thing that's really funding this is foundations like the one I was running at that time. But meanwhile, really beefing up the relationship with the business sector, because as we know later on about how elections take place, you need it, so the informal system. And so when I witnessed this part, you had to make a decision. Are you a manager of an organization? Is it my job just to implement? And I crossed the line and I became an activist. There was a point where in my life, I said, I think I need to take a position now, which led to me being, you know, pissing off George Soros and having, you know, and then also pissing off, you know, the president of Albania at that time, Berisha, and absolutely upsetting the US government. Because I took a position and said, this guy is wrong and I will side with these people. And you pay dearly for it. The only difference is that if you do take a position like that, I encourage everybody should, you should know the consequences of taking those positions. In some places, unfortunately, some people go to prison or are killed. In my situation, I knew the worst thing that would happen to me is that I become unemployed, which I was willing to accept. And it was at that point that I also crossed in between this Albanian American, where I crossed in and became more Albanian than I was an American. In a sense, my identity with that particular group. A long-winded answer, I apologize.
Fran, has everything anything changed since then? I mean, you've been in Albania from the first steps, like post-communism.
You know what?
Sorry?
It has. Look, you know, Albania is more developed. It's got roads, people like, you know, more highly educated people, whatever. What's not developed is your political system.
That's what I wanted to say. How much has our politicians changed since then? I mean, the names are still the same.
Right. You know, Albania, you know, what I don't like is a sin of equalizer. Well, Albania is like that, but so is, you know, Serbia. No, let's just, with Albania, the politicians quickly learned that it was an opportunity rather than a civic responsibility. The wealthiest people in Albania today are your political leaders, who are very closely aligned to your businesses or the oligarchs, who were created quite often by the politicians. Albania is in the process of becoming a captured state. It's been in that process for a very long time. You know, sooner or later, someone's just going to cross it. And to a large extent, I think that the reason why it hasn't, it's because so closely to Europe, and also I think the general public would probably take to the streets if there was actually a defiance against the Europeans or the Americans that we, you know, as a Georgia did a long time ago. But it's on the brink. It's a system where if we look at it, and we looked at it logically, and we looked at it patiently, and we looked at it objectively, we would find that no major company from the United States or Europe has ever invested in Albania. The privatization issue has not been resolved. Your health issues have not been resolved. Your educational problems have not been resolved. Your water, your electricity, the basic fundamental things that you need for a functioning state have not been addressed. Yet, billions and billions of dollars have been spent by the internationals to address all these issues. At the same time, Europe, meaning the Tirana governments, also have money to address these issues. So then the question is, what happened? Did you get it? I didn't get it. You didn't get it. Someone got it, and what we know. But yet, as I said from the beginning of this podcast, is that the Albanians love to live in failure. And that's what I mean by that, is that you continuously re-elect different names for the same exact system.
Pedro?
Yes, thanks, Fran. I pulled up an article you wrote in 2011 where you speak about this, and I wanted to read a paragraph because it's so well written. It says, let me read you the title. The title is, "Can Civil Society Survive in a Free Market Economy?" And then the paragraph I love says, "The law of the jungle thwarted the development of the rule of law. The words free market became a green light for financial misdeeds and Ponzi schemes. The mass media, especially television, has produced sensationalistic pabulum for the unfettered masses." It's unlettered masses. It's so great. But it's a great article about what you briefly mentioned just now about privatization, right? In the sense that we push the world to privatize all around the world, and the United States didn't privatize. So how did that work, not only in Albania, but in the Balkans and beyond?
So privatization is probably one of the most, if I was going to teach a course in university about international development, the issue that I would look at is privatization. And then the second part is, how do you write a proposal? Two really, really important. You must understand these two things if you want to understand international development. So the West, Europe, and the United States came in the post-communist societies with certain ideas about how to privatize property. One of the, you know, everything from vouchers to, you know, what's the name, Sachs in Poland coming up with a cold shower, sell everything, who cares, just get rid of it. And what you did in 2 seconds with the privatization, you went from a command economy to the most libertarian ideas without actually having some kind of, you know, slow process of creating the structures, the governing structures that can allow to actually monitor the process. But it was this rush to introduce this market economy and this very liberal, libertarian economy that in the process, unfortunately, it collapsed. There's very few success stories. You know, Albania being one of the best examples of where it's failed, especially when it comes to its southern area, which is a huge attraction for tourism. But because the privatization has never been addressed properly, where the same property has been sold over and over again by the various governments that came into power, they've had, as I said earlier, had a hard time of attracting serious investors. And that's been one of the critical things that people forget. Why is it that Western Europeans, or Americans for that matter, large companies, because they want to deal with very clear entitlement. You're both lawyers, you know this better than I do. They don't want to know that tomorrow Frau Nazi is coming over and says, hey, that property has been in my, you know, family for 1,000 years and here's the deed. You know, they just don't want to deal with that. And that's been one of the hindering problems of not only Albania, but other countries. The other issue regarding, you know, privatization, the thought was that if you privatize, the expectations were really set high. The thought was if you privatize, the entire economy will will rise. And it never happened. And so then finally, someone finally had to stop and think, oh, and excuse me, who are you guys that are recommending this? Do you have any experience in privatization? Maybe in joint ventures, maybe they have a company going from, you know, some of the state companies that you owned went private, but not in that sense. And it was an experiment where each time when it went wrong, the best response was like, well, let me try again in a different country because I think I got it this time. And one of the things that we learned from that was much late, unfortunately, in the game is that we could have actually rather relied on just Europeans or Americans. We should have turned to places like Latin America and some of the African countries that actually did go through the process, that actually had the real experience. Didn't work great, but they actually had the real experience of going through it. And one of the other issues that comes up, you know, it's not the privatizations, obviously, but the secret dossiers, which still hasn't been resolved in a lot of these places, in particular Albania, which again, sometimes, you know, we tend to look at the West and the United States as saying they can provide us answers to this. Quite often, the Westerners are getting the answers based on studies that they did in Latin America and elsewhere. And one of the things that we tried to do under my tenure was saying, why don't we just bring the source here and just talk to the people who actually tried to do this, rather than talking to somebody who actually did research, wrote a really good paper. This is why the proposal is very important. And we're able to actually communicate it very nicely, came in and said, we can do this for you. So.
And it also comes back to agency, right? Because you spoke about agency and dignity at the beginning, right? And
it is. Well, so for example, in the Albania is a really unique case because in 1992, they begin to introduce the privatization, it was a little earlier than that, but they really created privatization office. And there was a mad rush about how to sell the property. And property was being sold for nothing at all. And people, what were people doing with that money? Well, they were taking it to go to Italy or Greece for that matter, or at least send somebody out. It wasn't being used for, you know, and for that, you know, for the purpose that was supposed to meant to be, which is start sort of a whole economy. And as far as the individuals that were concerned, and it's not only Albania, and I'll be jumping if you think I'm wrong here. In Albania, there wasn't this identity with the property or with the country, as you would have like in neighboring Kosovo or elsewhere. In fact, they'd love to get rid of it and say, I never hope to never see it again. It was, and this is, I remember these conversations very well. It wasn't a strong feeling that I don't want to sell my grandfather's property. It was like, no, I will sell it and get out of here. I hope to never see it. And so in the process, you know, something that really people didn't talk about too much was that it allowed for a very easy sale as long as I get something, what you do with it afterwards, if it was resolved legally or not, that's a whole nother issue.
Fran, I know this might be a tough question to answer, but what do you consider your biggest achievement in Albania? And if you wanna say also, let's say your failure, I'm not gonna say your biggest failure, but the failure that you had in Albania.
The biggest achievement was these bi-monthly poetry contests, which cost me approximately, the whole budget I think was $1,000 for 1 year. So we tried, we were spending millions on education and the government and everything else, and it was just, and then someone came up with this crazy idea to hold these ridiculous bi-monthly contests where we would try to break the taboos between the city and these urban areas. And the whole thing was a setup. We would guarantee that whatever village we went to, that the local were always top in top three. And the idea was really for, as you know better than I do, because Albania was so isolated with the rural areas from this, it was a matter of saying that you have more similarities than you do have sort of, you know, differences. And it was a matter of these guys meeting under a, and hearing and learning. And it was incredible watching the youth of Tirana, very sophisticated at that time. At that time, they were dealing with issues of drugs, which was brand new. They were dealing with a lot of issues, but allow them also with their peers and also with some of the other more senior people to actually express themselves about some of the issues that they were facing. That went completely on the radar. That program, I would say, taught me something that I would continue to use in most of my programs, which was get out of the capital, go to the rural areas. Because the capital would take care of itself. Money was always there. So the biggest failure was a lot. The reason why you fail in international development is because you write a proposal. If anybody you talk to and says, I have not failed in international development, they're lying to you. You have to fail. Because when you submit a proposal or an idea, you're saying, this is what my achievements will be. We will develop civil society, we'll develop good governance, we'll develop this, and we can say that we've pushed the bar a little bit, but to say we fully developed it is a lie. So my failure in Albania was that, one was I didn't manage to do that very well, develop a real strong civil society at a time when I really had all the money in the world. The second failure is that maybe I should have played more of the manager position and less as an activist. Because I got to know so well, I got to know Albania so well that I think I would have played a better role if I maybe stayed there longer than exiting after 2-3 years as I did. The other failure in Albania was that we went in there with really believing in dealing with the policies and dealing with sort of think tanks, rather than in fact spending most on money, which I still believe in, which is secondary and primary education, not only in the capital, but also outside the capital. But at that time, it was very fashionable to start building these elite institutions. And I fell into that trap as well.
Yeah, Pedro.
I wanted to come back to that because you just said that it would have been better as a manager than as an activist. But you earlier said that it was a very principled decision, I guess. It's something important where you draw a line, right? There's something happening and you don't agree with it, so you draw the line because that makes you sleep better, right? Not
yeah, when you should do that at the age of 26, 30, and 35. You should definitely be an activist. It's really important. As a middle-aged white male, you realize that sometimes being there and having the know-how and the skills, you would have probably a bigger impact. So you don't rush into it. Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't change a thing what I did. I'm proud of what I stood for. And maybe it's a bit selfish because when you stand up, you know, not that you're going to win the Nobel Peace Prize, but in the back of your ridiculous subconscious mind, you're like, oh, I'm standing for something, but others have been bigger and better than you ever will be as long as you live. But then as you grow older, you say the game is much more complex. It's about knowing when to jump. And there was a lot more that we could have done looking back upon it now at the age I'm in. That if I stayed on as a manager, then I think as I did as a so-called activist. And the case in point, after I left, that was it. There was no more of the foundation did not play an activist role. It stopped funding some of these other kind of programs that I was pushing for. It became straightforward, a very, very close alignment to the government. And that was, game was over. Suddenly, the one financial resources that a lot of independent thinkers had was gone. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
So in terms of the civil society, like, because I'm really concerned about the civil society in Albania, like it's voiceless, first of all, it's non-existent. I mean, a few months ago, the National Theater was demolished. And a couple of days after the demolition, I just went out checking the Facebook pages of these NGOs, think tanks, to see if they reacted to this outrageous act of the government, like in the middle of the day. And out of 27 that I checked, only two of them actually had been there in the protest and actually had raised their voice against what the government was doing. And it was really concerning because these were human rights NGOs, think tanks that were supposed to promote good governance, rule of law, democracy, etc. And then on the other side, we have, let's say, civil society in Kosovo, which is extremely different. Like, there are so many think tanks, they're so active. They go speak to their politicians, they raise voice to any injustice. I mean, why? Because at the end of the day, we're both sides are Albanians. Like, we have the same mentality. So what's different between Albanian youth, Albanian activists, and Albanian Kosovars, Kosovo Albanians in Kosovo?
There's actually a huge difference between the two communities. There really is. One is Kosovo comes from a history of activism. Keep in mind, I defied Serbian rule for a number of years, created a parallel state. It learned without international funding how to create civic society. It was a sense of community, a sense of responsibility and accountability to this thing that would become a state someday. It was very important for Kosovo's development. I'll just skip a little bit. Approximately 800,000 or more refugees from Kosovo were forced out of their country during the NATO bombing in 1999. About 500,000 in Albania and then the rest in Macedonia, neighboring Montenegro. Not one crime was committed. Think about it, not one crime. Nobody reported a theft, nothing. And then when the international community said, now stand up, can you go back? They all went back. So there is a huge difference because I think of the history they come out of. Civil society in Albania is one that was created by the donors. It's a donor-driven service. There were service providers. They weren't a civic. The only civic person I know in Albania is my dear friend Fatos Lubojnaj, who in many ways represents what civic society should be, very vocal, very critical of every single regime, maybe a bit too far sometimes, but God bless him for it. So in Albania, we created, meaning it was I created, when I ran the foundation there, I created that society along with other donors. We told them what we're looking for and they developed it around that idea. In Kosovo, they actually had a history of it. They also, you know, were able to actually to come together because they were easy to identify the enemy, which happened to be Belgrade in Serbia. In Albania, it was very difficult to identify the common enemy because it was everywhere. Everybody was a communist. Even I was accused of a communist. Everybody was a spy. I was accused of a spy. And then that's when I felt like, oh, I'm finally Albanian, right? Because I'm being accused of the same thing everybody else has been accused, right? But from a development perspective, you seem, you know, that's great. So what unites you? I get what divides you guys. But what brings you together? And that's something I could never figure out.
I mean, like not longer than this morning, I received a message in Facebook actually from a fake profile asking me if I was a communist. This morning. Because of a Facebook post apparently that I posted later.
I mean, I feel sorry for Pedro, he has to hear this, but when I went to Albania in 1991, I couldn't find one communist. And I actually wanted to find one. Just to talk to him, going, hey, or talk to her. What was it like? Why did you become a communist? Everybody said it was a Democrat in 1991 when I went there. Wait a minute.
Yeah, Hawks' wife was still alive, I think.
But it was interesting. She was, you know, she was more of a capitalist in many ways actually than the average person. But from the intellectuals that represented the democratic movement. So one of the things that you learn about movements is that there has to be a sense of how do you call it, truth in it. You know, Nelson Mandela is a perfect example. People forget, you know, that the movement was a Marxist movement over there, that he came in and a person who came clean and said, this is who I was then, this is who I am today, but didn't try to shed the past and hide it. He took it with him and said, because you have to become, there has to be sort of a a process where you say, because you introduce a certain culture of truthfulness in the actual new organization or new, you know, movement by actually looking upon your past and admitting to it. But in Albania, many, not all, many actually try to hide that. You know, Berisha, who, for the record, I have a ongoing fight with, which he's one of the few people still remembers me in Albania, just for the record. So that feels good every once in a while when he curses at me. But Berisha tried to shed his past and pretend like he was always a Democrat. And that, to me, I think corrupted the idea behind a Democratic Party. Because in name, it should have said, we don't care. You come over here, as long as you're willing to accept by the rules, we don't care what you believe in. Yeah. Because the rules and rule of law are stronger than your identity with one party versus the other. But it was this belief that you had to be completely cleansed of the previous, or break free completely of the previous system in order to start a new system. It never works.
And Frank, do you think we need to go back through this process of like who was a communist and who was not? Because it's right now in Albania it's being discussed a lot. And especially one side is attacking the other, saying like, look, you're saying that we don't want communists. You're attacking those who are communists, but in fact you still have communists in your ranks.
I'll be honestly, I know this is going to sound terrible. I have no idea what communism means in Albania.
Yeah, same.
I really don't. I mean, are you talking about a certain kind of economic model? Or you're talking about the secret service kind of, you know, big brother? I don't know. If you're talking about this conspiracy theories and this misinformation, fake news before it became sort of popular, so I don't know what people mean. I think they probably mean the latter, which is saying that, you know, you have hidden agenda, you're not believable. And that's not really a sort of communism. That's sort of a product of a character and the moral of society. You know, and I hate to be so critical of of Albania, but you've got to come clean and once and for all and say, look, forget about communism. Let's just look from 1992 until now. And you have to ask the same question, is that what has been achieved? A lot, really, in the sense of Tirana. You created a great city state called Tirana, but the rest of the rural area still has a long ways to go. So why was that? Number one reason is corruption.
And it continues too, right?
Yeah.
The rural areas are being depopulated, like people are leaving rural areas, either going to Tirana or just leaving the country. Like, I'm sad to say it, but I know that you come from the region of Puka, and
I do.
Day by day, Puka is like, people are leaving that area, like, it's really...
But I come from Puka because of the mythical, when I was telling you before, early on, because my father talked about it, because my clan comes from there, and blah, blah, blah. But all kidding aside, I identify much more with New York than I do with Albania. My habits, the way I speak, the way I think, the way I act is a typical New Yorker. The nice thing about it is that the attitude of New Yorkers are very similar to those in the Balkans. So I kind of get, you know, so I can get away with both. You know, we have a habit of talking, you know, if you pull a little weight on, we're not politically correct, either in New York or in the Balkans. We tell you, hey. You know. But you know, as much as I like to say that there was a point where I thought I understood Albania, which I think I did, my views are completely and heavily, I should say, impacted my upbringing in New York.
I wanted to bring one of my favorite people is Churchill, who I think applies to Berisha. One of the best insults that Churchill had against one of his alleged enemies was that he called Adelie not a wolf in sheep's clothing, but a sheep in sheep's clothing, right? So I guess that could apply to Berisha in the sense that one must see people for who they are, right? I wanted to come back to failures, right? Because another phrase apocryphally attributed to Churchill is that success is going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm, right? Or or success is really failing better.
Yep.
Right. So I wanted to come back to the failures because I think we don't, or you've taught me this, and full disclosure, right? You've taught me most, what I know is what you've taught me, and I hope I can call you a friend and a comrade in arms, but how does one fail better, right? How does one does it in Latin America? What are the questions one must be asking?
So, look, I started learning about Latin America a little late in my career, and I was absolutely blown away by the amazing organizations I found. I really mean it. But they came from this history, as you know better than I do, because of lessons learned from the 60s and 70s with the USAID and USCOM. So they were always critical of everything, very skeptical about what they're trying to do. And their mission, 99% of the time, was grassroots. It's just fascinating about how they just got it. I mean, really, from the organizations I work with, even the universities, which we had some dealings with, you know, they talk about really high profile stuff, but the minute you get into discussion with them, they bring it back to the grassroots. Latin Americans and me also show that extremely smart, extremely high educated people, just like, you know, you'd find in Eastern Europe, the difference is they went back and are teaching at those universities. They're actually going into the field. That doesn't happen in Albania. So as far as failing is concerned, I made a decision because of the influence I had from the intellectuals of Central and Eastern Europe. They really impacted me a lot during my time, is that you have to be critical of your work because you went in there with great intentions, and you also understand how easy it is to be corrupted from your ideas. Because you're running a lot of money. For example, my average project was between $1 million to $15 million. So if you look at that, it's very easy to go into these undeveloped countries or developing countries, if you want to call them, where suddenly it's easy for you to become corrupt and you're thinking that you know what you're doing. Because most of your staff is local staff. Most of the people you're dealing with obviously need the funding. So I decided to take on the challenge of what more should be done. We did this, what needs to be done. But also you came from experience saying, what do we need to do to inspire, with all respect, just use you as an example, Pedro, to continue after funding has dried up. So the exchange of ideas, the exchange of how to function. So the project in many ways that was being funded, I ran, became a vehicle for actually just meeting and talking and bringing this, what I call the HANA net, which is we're not promoting democracy. We're not promoting anything. We're promoting a space where we can actually have structural criticism, a debate where we don't judge each other. So in every place I worked in the Balkans, usually it was coffee shops, in the Caucasus, usually it was something else, you try to bring this sort of space there, where not only they're critical of their society, but to do that, you had to become sort of the model of it, where I became critical of my own programs. In Georgia, I ran a $15 million project. Every month I used to go out there in the rural areas and report to the Georgians how I spent the money that month. And it used to drive them crazy. The thought was not only for me to learn from that, but for saying, look, if you want to move ahead, we have to introduce this kind of culture where we report, we get feedback, we don't get mad at each other, we don't talk the next day, we try to fix it. As far as your generation is concerned, I think this is something that really is really dear to me. If climate change is for real, which I believe it is, in 2050 is what we have, my generation owes your generation an explanation of what worked and didn't work in concrete terms. Because you do not have the luxury of failing. You really don't. You don't have the luxury of experimenting the way we did with privatization or other programs. We have to get it right. And what I mean by that is that you have to incorporate issues related to climate change in all aspects of development, rule of law, civil society, good governance, education, and so forth. Even though it's an industrial state problem we created, meaning the United States and Western Europe, unfortunately, the impact is greater on these developing countries.
And doing it with criticism, right? It's you have to do it in that I don't know how you call it. I don't know where that comes from. I would love to ask you more if you have more time, because it's philosophers call it epistemological humility, right? So where does that come from? Because since I've had the pleasure and honor of working with you, you really have an intolerance for nonsense, right? And it's a great place to work and live and grow, because you allow that, you ask for it, and hopefully it makes programs better. But where does that sense of giving and taking, how does that work? Where does that, how do we train that? You talked about poetry, but how does it work?
Yeah, so in the beginning, what we said is that you have to be an idealist. So when I went into this field, I didn't expect to make money. To me, it was just the fact that I was going to be part of impacting society. And to one day, that I have a son now, to tell him, I played a small role in WASH society. And I would say it was an idealist approach. The second part of that answer is that at a very young age, I was put ahead of a major foundation with a lot of money. And I realized quickly that, as I was saying earlier, it's really easy to become a dictator of goodwill. It really is. And it's seductive, and you fall into that trap. And I learned my lesson very, very quickly that you're being seduced. And trust me, I made tons of mistakes. And as much as I like to blame it on the review committees, it's not. It was under my direction. We gave money to a lot of organizations, individuals that maybe we shouldn't have. But you fell into that. It's a nice feeling where everybody calls your name, applauds you. And so there's a point where you say that you have to have some doubt in what you're doing. You have to question yourself, especially in international development or if you're running a foundation. Every day you have to ask yourself, every morning, who can I talk to give me a different perspective? My biggest criticism of not only the Soros Foundation, but most foundations, is that they should have term limits on your executive directors. It should be 4 years, full stop. Not because they're bad, but because you need in order to question these things. It's easy to fall into that system.
Yeah, and most of those have had executive directors forever. Ken Roth, for all his great, he's been there.
And I think in our sector, we ask for politicians to have term limits. We have, there's a few things in there we have to do. They get paid a lot of money. I mean, when I went into this sector, it was unheard of, I was making less money in Albania than I was when I was working in New York City. But you didn't go in for that. You had to almost put some skin in the game. It wasn't about the fact that you get a $500,000 or $300,000 a year salary with a nonprofit organization. It was you're recruited and saying, what do you give? I can give half of my salary. We're going to give you the other half for the privilege and honor, honestly, to get involved and to pretend. And it really is, you're pretending because you're making stuff up, that you're going to try to help this particular country. This is the most amazing, craziest idea in the world.
Yeah, and never forget who you're trying to help, which I think is what you're saying, right? You have to speak to the people who you're affecting.
When you do that, when you go in and you have skin in the game, you have the right to also criticize your own organization because you're a partner with that organization. And so, again, it's very easy to fall into the trap of working with the elite. And it's very easy to work with, English-speaking locals who know the system, who know the Yankees, who know the difference in the Knicks. Very easy to fall. But true development work is about grassroots. And the part that we have to get back to is that we have to realize in 90% of the society, there's a really strong social fabric that keeps the society together. And that is usually found at the grassroots level. And you have to be very careful how you address it, because you don't want to break that up. It could be in a neighborhood, it could be in a village, it could be in a town, it could be in a city, but that social fabric is what keeps society functioning. And we have to make sure that we don't take the key components of those individuals or civic leaders outside of that fabric. And quite often we did. We actually bribed them by saying, look, Pedro, come here and I'll give you $100,000, you create a think tank. And Pedro does that. But unfortunately now we just disrupted this fascinating thing there. You know, in USAID, they call it do no harm, and there's a lot of terms for it. But those are some of the lessons learned that we kind of go, oh boy, I wish I had to redo that again. I would have been much more conscious about that.
Right, and sorry, Albie, and it's also a criticism of neoliberalism, right? Because that's what the free market does. It takes people away. It's free movement of capital, not of people, and it destroys communities in one way.
Well, look, first of all, a lot of these people, you know, have the right to market economy. We forget that, you know. You know, human rights, as you know very well, because we discussed this prior to this podcast, it was, you know, everybody got mad because Russia was saying that economics is a human right. And the West said, no. Yes. Trust me. If you've been poor, yeah, it's an economic right. I want, you know, human right. I want access to better myself as well. So I didn't see nothing wrong in that respect. What I did see was that what we were talking earlier, with the speed by which they try to introduce these market reforms. Because you can't take away the right to travel, the right to movement, or you know, to better yourself, or you know, it becomes an intellectual discussion. No, they have those rights. So how do you actually, you know, provide them with the means to actually exercise those rights? And you go back to the function of the rule of law. Are you punishing the people because they have a bad government or because they're bad people? And that's the question many times Albanians kept asking. Why are you punishing us? Because you have a bad government who doesn't know how actually to comply to the EU rules and regulations? So it was, and that has to do with the identity of a state or not, with the nation state, if you want to call it. It's a very, very tough discussion, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I have one more question, maybe, or two more. The first one, and I'll say them both. The first one is about the Open Society Foundations, right? Because that's, you mentioned how when you were working, you might have wanted to go back to university to read more. And one of those books, which is famous, is The Open Society and Its Enemies, written by Karl Popper, who George Soros took upon to create probably the most or the wealthiest foundation that has ever existed. So what about the Open Society and its enemies, Karl Popper and George Soros, is good and what is bad? But the other thing I wanted to ask about, to bring it back to today, is I still think that one line in your op-ed on the Hill about disinformation is so important, and it always gets lost, right? And that line is that if we want to drive out disinformation, misinformation, fake news, you say in that op-ed on the Hill, disinformation campaigns often identify and explode the vulnerabilities of a given society, such as racism, discrimination, and nationalism. It makes good sense for Western democracy development efforts to tailor their technological collaboration, educational training, public outreach assistance to focus on grassroots movements working to address these vulnerabilities. And I think that's so important. It's always missing from all these things.
So the first one, the open society concept, I mean, this is a true story. George Soros called me out of the blue and asked me if I want to go to Albania to set up a foundation. I said yes without actually having any idea what salary, and really, I had no idea what my salary was going to be. I had no idea what Open Society was. I had no idea what some society was. I had no idea what a foundation was. And all I knew was that some weird guy is about to pay my airfare to go and watch a revolution in Albania. As I yeah, I do. And I literally memorized the Open Society pamphlet that, you know, this is a society, do this. I'm like, oh yeah, I can do this. It sounds like a piece of cake, right? And during the time when they were bringing a communist system, it all made sense because you can identify the enemy, you get a face to it, and all you have to do is just bring it down. Simple. I could do this. And I did. Brought in a ton of newspapers, newsprint. We supported the opposition. We supported all these people that were against totalitarian systems. And I was like, yes. And then you realize the open society concept that Karl Popper was talking about. It's a great theory, which he stole from Plato. And does it really work? Well, the whole idea with open society, as you know, is that there's a few theories to it. One is, as I said earlier, you have to have at least 5% doubt in anything that you do. The second thing is that, you know, the assumption is made that you're never right. The assumption is made that you have groups of people that try to make a decision. Well, the entire process of foundations, the way we're set up, is completely closed. Because in order to actually bid for a grant at a foundation, you have to have the ability to write. I don't care what language, but you have. The second one, you have to have access to these documents, especially then when you didn't have the internet. So in fact, in many ways that it wasn't because we didn't want to, but we couldn't because the system we set up was actually catering to a specific group, which is the same group that benefited from the previous system. It's also one of the reasons why today philanthropic organizations have such a bad reputation in Europe and Eastern Europe and elsewhere. Right? What George Soros did for me is probably one of the greatest heroes I ever had the fortune of knowing. And with all that he did was he, in my opinion, he made a few mistakes. One was we confused the people we were working with by the way the foundations operated. On one hand, we helped civil society, and also on the other hand, we helped governments. We sent mixed messages. Are you with us? Are you with them? We want to be with both. And that's not the way Central and Eastern Europe, I'll just confine myself to that part, worked, because we came from a society of us versus them. It's black and white. And so there was mixed messages being sent. You know, you want to help the government, but meanwhile, you want to help society to hold the government accountable. And so the general, person on the street said, but wait a minute, you know more than I do, and yet you work with them, and you're asking me to hold them. So the whole thing was pretzel-logical. It was really very like a pretzel in a sense. So that caused a lot of chaos. The second thing was that with George Soros, it was hard to actually differentiate between George Soros, the man, and his foundations. Unfortunately, that's still the challenge they face today. George Soros has a right to his political views. He has a right to anything else. And he's tried really, really hard to keep the foundation separate from his political views. But you could try as much as you want today more than ever, unfortunately, based on, the fact that open society now is being fought online. That's just simply not the reality we work in. The two are really tied very close together. And the consequences sometimes, the positive and negatives that the foundations deal with because of such an active founder, is evident in any country you work around. One thing I liked a lot, which I credit George Soros for, is that he took risks on individuals. He was not afraid to gamble. And as much as he really was a businessman, that he would meet someone, and you hear these stories over and over again, just like myself, he turned around and gave a kid with no experience at all an opportunity to run a foundation just because I said, I'll do it. I think that's the only reason why, because I didn't say anything smart, I'll be frank with you. I know for a fact I didn't. I was just too busy, like in awe of his office in Central Park, overseeing Central Park. But he took the risk, so he still understood the importance of the individual. And now, obviously, it's become institutionalized. I don't know the foundation anymore. It's become way bigger than. But the fact that a 26 or 27-year-old kid can pick up the phone and call this billionaire and go, look, the president of Albania wants to develop a Chinatown, which is a true story. What do you think? And he's like, I don't know. I think it's a crazy idea, to be honest. I'm like, yeah, you're right, actually. The fact that it was at that level and that he made time, well, I always have this deepest respect for him. As far as the role the Open Society Foundation plays today, I think like a lot of foundations, it got away from the grassroots movements because we started seeing these countries graduate. Hungary started graduating, Poland, Czech Republic, Albania. So there's less and less and more about these policy and more about some of these other, direct aid to governments, funding Harvard University to do anti-corruption, what unilingual graduate students, this is more. But it's huge, and it's become, in a sense, a global player, which to me, what fascinated me is not only in Central and Eastern Europe, but United States as well. And so once a lot of the people who oppose the open society concept in Eastern Europe found an alignment with Americans, I think the game changed for the worse. Because prior to that, people are going to go, that's just some crazy form of communist thinking this way. But the minute you also have people in the United States who they saw as the beacon of light for democracy aligned with them, said, no, there must be some truth to this. And I think personally, he welcomes this fight as an individual. I'm just kind of curious to see how the foundations are going to deal with it in the long run. as I said early on, I'll stop right here, is that the reputations of philanthropic organizations in Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, and elsewhere has really gotten down. Most people see these philanthropic organizations as just benefiting one particular group. And the Soros Foundation has come under huge criticism for that. And I have two when I was its executive director.
Yeah, I don't know if Albie is dumbfounded with all these questions, but maybe one last one. It's Viktor Orban is probably the best example, right? Because Orban was a recipient of the Open Society grant. But of course, if you believe in the individual, right, you give people the right, and then you still fight him, right? You still advocate for an open society, no matter what. And they've done amazing work throughout the world, including Ken Roth, just for the record.
Look, he's keep in mind, for every, you know, Viktor Orban, there's others out there that, you know, the problem that, you know, also Open Society faces, that fortunately, unfortunately, a lot of people that he did educate ended up in government. So a lot of people saw this conspiracy theory as, oh, you know, he's a Soros person, so therefore Soros controls this. But look, the for me, when I ran his foundation, we got into a lot of fights. Was obvious because both, you know, very, I had my ideas based on the ground. He had his amazing ideas, which simply maybe, you know, that I didn't want to hear about. My problem with my foundation, when I ran the foundation, is we became a travel agency. I think I sent over, I think in a year's time, I think about 1,500 students or more in 1 year abroad. And I'm talking about some of the finest universities in the United States and Western Europe. And almost not one of them came back, except for, you know, Adi Chile's guy there, what's his name? The current Democratic Party leader.
Oh, Basham.
He came back.
Yeah. And many people right now in Albania, actually, like, they target people as a Soros guy, when in fact Basha was founded by the Soros Foundation.
And I kept my records because I said someday I'm probably, there'll be a civil society court that Pedro Pizano is going to create. And he's going to ask me to show my documents and make a case of why I shouldn't be put in Ticavelli's prison for all the money I spent in the name of democracy. So I actually kept the annual reports and what I worked on. And we funded Basha when I was the executive director back in 1993, I think it was.
I know, yeah. But many of his followers don't know that, don't accept that.
We also funded Berisha.
I know.
They're, we also happy. Funded a lot of other people that refused.
I know. Fran, like, we've reached the 1 hour mark.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you so much for being here today with me and Pedro. Maybe, who knows, we'll have other discussions in the future. Pedro, like, you're family now in Rule of Law Albania podcast, so I'll have you back once in a while.
Not too much, please.
Yeah, Albie, Pedro, thank you. It's a pleasure. I hope I didn't bore you guys too much, but it is what it is, as they say, right? But thank you so much. I really appreciate being on here.
Thank you, Fran. We really appreciate it. And we wish you the best of luck. And we can't, or at least I can't, thank you enough for everything.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Pedro.
Same for me.
No.